you know, Jeff Carlin told me about this monologue. Why don't you have fun with it? You know, find the fun in it. Find the fun you used to have. You got to have fun, John. And my wife, Betty's been telling me the same thing. Have fun. The boys, Tom Serafin, a lot of people. John, have fun. And I'm thinking, okay, what do you want me to do? Take a chicken and stick a beer can up its butt again? Or what? Look, I'm a conservative in Chicago. You know what that means? I get my ass kicked for a living. But let's have fun, okay? I just heard that Fast Eddie Verdoliak was going to be sentenced to prison. I don't know. As I've talked to you now, it hasn't been finalized, so I don't know. But his lawyers seem to think he'll do about 10 months. He's already been in prison, did 11 months in 2010, released before Thanksgiving in 2011. And as I write this, they expect him to go away again for the tobacco deal. You want to know about fun? Covering Fast Eddie was fun. Covering Harold Washington was fun. Jane Byrne and all that. And the city council wars. That was fun. Back then, Fast Eddie was de facto mayor. Boss of the Cook County Democrats. Prince of the city. And when I was a kid reporter working at the Daily Calumet on the southeast side, where he was king, another reporter and I, Mark Eisman, my friend who passed away this year, well, we tried to put him in jail on a deal, towing all the abandoned autos off the city streets. It was layered and complicated, and money, millions of dollars back then, was exchanged. I think Jane Byrne got $25,000 in political contributions. Maybe, I think Eddie got about $15,000. Just, you know, that's stuff on the books. We thought we had him, and we kept writing stories about it, and Carol Marin would read our stuff on the air when it hit the UPI wires. And that helped us get a job at the Tribune. She'd start it. The Daily Calumet is reporting today. Verdoliak this, Verdoliak that. Illinois Scrap this or that. It was something. It was fun. So anyway, around that time, Verdoliak invites me out for breakfast on the east side. Forgot where it was, right near 96 and Commercial. He's eating his eggs, and I don't want to eat eggs. I'm just drinking coffee, and he says, hey, do you figure out who the attorney was that put that scrap deal together? He meant the contract with the city. And he pointed to a name on a document. The name was of a lawyer who just became the U.S. attorney of the Northern District. That's how slick he was. He didn't go to jail, did he, for that one? He was so slick. He was so quick. He's now 83. His lawyers say he has a brain tumor, probably due 10 months. Columnist Mark Brown at the Sun-Times, a good columnist and a good man, wrote a good column about Verdoliak, saying he wanted him sentenced to sit in a room and explain Chicago politics to those who don't know how it works. But you see, Verdoliak has already done that. He did it all the time, out in public, by example, by his deals, by his Mephistophelian charm. It was always about the tribes for Eddie. And in 1996, wow, that's a long time ago, right? I quoted him in a magazine profile I did on Richard M. Daley, the younger, you know, Mayor Fredo to you, for the Chicago Tribune's Sunday magazine. It was the magazine profile came out on the day that the Democratic National Convention opened. I thought it had a chance for a Pulitzer, but, you know, who am I kidding? I still might post it on Facebook. Fast Eddie hated Richard M. Daley, Mayor Fredo, Mayor Chucky. He respected Mayor Richard J. Daley and feared him, but who didn't? It was the younger Daley who ran against Jane Byrne, Verdoliak's candidate, and split the white vote and made Harold Washington mayor that bothered Verdoliak. And then Mayor Fredo took advantage of the Civil War among black politicians in the aftermath of Harold Washington's sudden death, and he split them and rode in as the mayor who would bring stability to Chicago, which was called then by the Wall Street Journal, Beirut by the Lake. Of course it was cynical. That's politics. And he held power, Daley did, for about 20 years and just about killed the city in debt. That magazine piece in 1996 that begins with a terrified Maggie Daley running all over Chicago trying to find her husband. She couldn't find him. She called everybody. She ran all over the neighborhood. She finally finds him in bed in his father's house with a cold, and there's Vicks vapor rub on his chest. And in that piece, I quoted Fast Eddie. You've got to understand something about the Irish, the Daily Irish, Fridoliak says. The grandfather in him fading. The Fast Eddie coming out. It's the Irish first, then everybody else is a Polack. Everybody. I'm Croatian, and to them I was a Polack. The blacks are Polacks. Latinos, everybody. Lekowitz, Wojcik, they're all Polacks. That's how they are. The Irish are a minority, but they have all the jobs, the political jobs, the big political spots. Why? Fridoliak said. They play divide and conquer. It's smart politics, but it's more than that. It's more than that with them. They're the Dailies on the inside, and everybody else is outside, all Polacks. Now, I'm not against the Irish, and I don't think he is either, and I'm definitely not against the Poles. I mean, didn't I recommend that Henry Sienkiewicz be given his own special day? But it was always about the tribes with Eddie. This tribe, that tribe. And that was one of the most honest things I've ever heard said out loud about the politics of this city, as it was and as it still is, because those tribes have different names now. Okay, there were the Irish, the Poles, the Italians, blacks, Latinos, etc. And now we have the progressives and the socialists and the Northwest side and the Southwest side. And the Democrats are all about identity politics now. And what is that? What is identity politics but identifying people not by who they are but what they are, by their skin, by their gender? And what is that? Besides racism, it's tribalism. It's all about tribes. And Chicago is less the city of neighborhoods than the city of tribes. And that, too, is the Chicago way. Today, we'll be talking about other tribes nationally, what's going on in Georgia, what's happening with Attorney General William Barr, those coronavirus rules for thee but not for me political hypocrites, and all of this with our friend, writer and political scientist Charles Lipson, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, and co-host Jeff Carlin, who wants me to have fun again, is here as always. He's executive producer at WGN Radio, and if we sound halfway decent today, it's because Jeff makes it so, and I hope he takes care of me popping my peas. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. And you, if you're old enough, trying to remember Fast Eddie Fridoliak, that wolf, that political wolf, and those coronavirus political hypocrites blubbering when they get caught. One thing about Eddie, wasn't a hypocrite. And you're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As I said, our guest is Charles Lipson, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, writer, thinker, scholar, and friend. And he's got a great piece that I saw in the Real Clear Politics, but it's also, I think, in some of the Georgia papers. The Georgia runoffs and our embattled constitution, in which Charles Lipson talks about the singular issue of the day, which is Georgia. Does Georgia hold the balance, whether we stay a free republic or pack the courts and have the socialist Democrats control everything and the Supreme Court becomes irrelevant and popularized and the rule of the mob? What happens, Charles?
Well, obviously, Georgia is critical to who controls the Senate. The Republicans currently have 50 seats, and the next election is not for 2 years beyond the Georgia runoffs. If the Democrats win both races in Georgia, it'll be a 50-50 tie, and the tie will be broken by the vice president and the vice president-elect, unless President Trump can overturn it with the fraud claims and so forth, will be Kamala Harris. So that would give the Democrats a working majority. Now, what do they do with a working majority? And the first thing to know is that each new Congress, the House of Representatives, sets its own rules for that Congress, and the Senate does the same thing. And one of the rules that they set, they can modify the rules during the year, but one of the rules they set is, when do you need more than a simple majority, that is 50 votes plus the broken tie by the vice president, to accomplish things? And that supermajority is known as the filibuster. In 2013, I think it was, Harry Reid changed the filibuster rule, which is currently that you would need 60 votes for certain things, changed that to a simple majority because he wanted to pass the nominees that President Obama had at the time for the local courts, the trial courts at the federal level. Yes, the federal courts at the trial level and the appellate level. In Chicago, we're in the Seventh Circuit and so forth. And I think it's also now applies, and maybe it applied then, to cabinet members. When the first Supreme Court nomination came up during the Trump presidency, by then the Republicans controlled the Senate, and Mitch McConnell made it a simple majority to get a Supreme Court nominee through. And what that means is that if you were to drop that for everything in the new Senate, first of all, the Senate would look exactly like the House. So that Nancy Pelosi has had a small majority in the House. She doesn't need to get any Republican votes if she can carry her entire Democratic caucus. What one Democrat has said, Joe Manchin, the most moderate or centrist member of the Democratic caucus, has said, is that he would not favor eliminating the filibuster for everything. If the filibuster were eliminated, then the Democrats might be able to push through two new states that would vote Democratic, the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, if Puerto Rico voted to become a state once Congress allowed it. And of course, Biden would sign that, and that could lock in a long-term majority. And you couldn't really, people say, well, you know, you get a new election in 2 years, and doesn't that serve as a check? But no, I mean, you can't boot out Utah from being a state or Illinois from being a state, and you couldn't boot these two new states out. So it would change things. Personally, I don't think the Democrats would go immediately for packing this Supreme Court because there would be a lot of pushback. But I do think what they would say is, we need more judges at the district level and the appellate level. Let's go ahead and add those new slots. And they would fill them all with Democrats. So you'd get a lot of courts that began to look like the California federal court, the Ninth Circuit, that just did everything the Democrats wanted.
Your piece in the Real Clear Politics and every and many other publications, I referred to it as by the headline, the Georgia runoffs and our embattled Constitution. You make the point that our founding, that we're dealing with the surface politics, but really there are deeper questions that deal with the Constitution. And we're not really focusing on that. Not you, but I mean the rest of us are not focusing on that. You talk about one-party rule and centralized government, because if the Democrats control Georgia, then they control both houses of Congress and the presumably the White House and the federal government. So how does this all play out?
Well, let's note that to begin with, that one-party rule is not new. I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had it. Barack Obama had it in the first 2 years of his administration. So did Trump in the beginning of his administration. Lyndon Johnson got all of his great society programs through with Democratic one-party rule. What I was saying is, I think look, let's go back and look at what the founders were concerned about. I wasn't trying to set up the Constitution, which I think is the greatest political document ever written, but I wasn't trying to set it up as if it was handed down to Moses on Mount Sinai.
Right. I see.
I was trying to set it up as a series of fundamental and long-term concerns that all of us in a constitutional democracy have about what could go wrong with our government. When the United States was formed, our first constitution was called the Articles of Confederation, and it did not allow the central government to do any taxing. And because you couldn't tax, you couldn't have an army or a navy. There were domestic rebellions. Of course, there are always foreign threats. And so when they got together in Philadelphia in 1787, their first decision was, we can't just reform this constitution. We have to set up a new one. They needed a more energetic central government. And they wanted to get it. But then they also had concerns about what could go wrong with that government. And those concerns that they have ought to be our concerns, too. And that is that the government could become so centralized, could trample over individual rights, and could gain more and more power that our democracy would be, that we would return to the tyranny we had fought against. So they set up bulwarks or barriers institutionally against that. The separation of powers, where you take the sovereign power that today is in Washington, D.C., and you say it won't all be in the hands of the president, or it won't all be in the hands of the Congress. And they divided that. And they assumed that that division would play an important role. They had two other crucial barriers, bulwarks that they set up. One was federalism, that a lot of power would go to the states. And the other was the Bill of Rights, which was added before the Constitution was ratified. It wasn't in the original Constitution. And that protects freedom of speech and religion and so forth, individual rights.
As we just saw recently in the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision against Governor Cuomo's pushing down upon a synagogue and a Catholic church. Right.
Exactly. Those rights, just because they're on paper, doesn't mean that they'll last forever. You have to continue pushing for them and fighting for them. But they assumed, and I think it was a brilliant assumption, that each institution, the presidency, they divided the power of the Congress between the Senate and the House, that each of these institutions would push to prevent the others from encroaching on its power. And that push and push back would prevent consolidated power. And then federalism would prevent all sovereign power from being consolidated in Washington, D.C., instead of some of it remaining in Springfield and some of it remaining in Salt Lake City and so forth. So what you have when you have one party rule, they didn't anticipate political parties. There weren't political parties when they wrote. They expected factions, which are kind of like our interest groups.
And you make the point in the piece, but you also, I think, highlight something that's pretty, I mean, also very important, at least to me. And that is that our founders did not think or didn't appreciate the vast power that the federal bureaucracy would have, given that the Congress doesn't really write laws anymore. They just write guidelines to allow the federal bureaucracy to govern us. And then you have the problem of the that you've written on before of a federal bureaucracy and certain people within it, perhaps loyal to another president who may be pulling their strings, taking the, using their powers inside the federal government to thwart and also attack the sitting president. I don't think these were ever envisioned by the founders.
Absolutely, nobody envisioned these kind of large bureaucracies that kind of move on their own. What I was saying is that our bureaucracy is really a fourth branch of government. We call it the executive branch, but it's misnamed in two ways. One is the way you just pointed out, which is although they're under the nominal control of the president of the United States, he's the only elected official in the executive branch. In many ways, they're semi-autonomous. They're a fourth branch. They have more autonomy and without any electoral control than any of the other branches. And the other thing is that the president it tries to control them, and the Congress sometimes tries to control them, but they can't really effectively control something as big and detailed as what Congress does. Congress now does, it, although it passes laws for sure, the laws, many of the big laws will have 2,000 or 3,000 points in the big laws that say the Secretary of Health and Human Services shall determine X, Y, or Z. And that's understandable. If you have an Endangered Species Act, it's going to have a lot of detail regulations in it that tell you how much pollution you can have in the water or whether you can conduct forestry on land that may have an endangered species or whatever it is. That's going to have to be done by detail. The question is, what prevents those bureaucrats, many of them experts, down in the trenches, from just conducting their own policies without any democratic oversight? And the other thing is that I would say that I didn't have a chance to include in the article, which was kind of on the long side, was we expect our government to do a lot more than anybody ever expected government to do in the past.
Well, one of them is, there's many Americans who I think believe it's the government's responsibility to extend everlasting life to everyone. I mean, it's getting to that point where there can be no risk. They have to protect us from everything and they have to make us happy.
And Charles, I got a point to that, the idea of, you know, where power lies and the never an envisioning of how things would be now, because when all these things were kind of written out, the concept of power was rooted more in ownership of land or property and not just wealth, you know, the ability to buy and sell. And now we've moved so far away from the idea of that, right or wrong, that money, the ability to influence others with your wealth, is really the stronger point. At least that's what my interpretation of history is.
That's it's an excellent point. Actually, when they wrote Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, the words pursuit of happiness substituted for the older phrase, which was borrowed from the English, which was life, liberty, and property. Because they believed that property rights should be inviolate, and in many ways they were supposed to be inviolate in the Constitution. And by property, they not only meant ownership of property, but the right of free individuals to make contracts with each other, free adults. We hardly pay much attention to that now. That is, if you wanted to hire me for $7 an hour, I'm an adult, you're an adult, you wanted to hire me for $7 an hour, and I wanted to take that job, the federal government and the state and local governments would step in and say, we couldn't do that because it's below the minimum wage. So they prevent those kinds of contracts as if they were prostitution or the sale of cocaine or something. So there's a lot of changes. My point was simply that the concerns that the founders originally had, that overly centralized power could become tyrannical, anti-democratic, trample our individual rights, is not a concern that people had only in 1787 or in 1865 or in 1965. It's a concern that we need to have now. And we need to think about how elections like the one in Georgia, which could lead to one party control, where so much power is centralized in Washington, and where the Senate won't defend its institutional interests against the president in the way that was originally intended, because they would be from the same party. They would tend to work in concert. For some people, that's very good. I have a colleague who's just written a book saying, gee, we need a lot more of that because we need a more energetic government. And you would get a more energetic government, but I think that the cost of that would be far too high. I think he's wrong.
Individual liberty is the only thing. And the larger the government, the more activist the government. I mean, I don't need to draw a map on a napkin. Everyone listening can see it.
I remember when we used to go out and there were things called napkins at things called restaurants.
Listen, I do have to ask you the two things that I thought I took away from. I mean, the one thing I took away from your piece on this was the role of the federal government and the Kamalists, as I call them, within the government. The only difference between our bureaucracy and the one of Ottoman Turkey, I think, is that let me cut to it. William Barr, Attorney General, who I've had on this podcast, he talked about he did two things that I thought were very important for all the loads of crap that the left has thrown into this man's lap. Number one, he stood up publicly and said the Justice Department does not see any widespread voter fraud, okay, which I thought was extremely significant. And the second thing he did was call up a special counsel or make John Durham the special counsel to keep investigating that which you have written about many, many times before, this takedown of the president by Comey, and other actors within the Obama administration that seemed to violate and be the greatest political scandal of our time that the media doesn't really care to discuss for partisan reasons. So those two things, I thought, what do you think about them, those two?
I think that Barr has actually been a great attorney general. He's, I know that probably you, me, and Mrs. Barr are the only people who think that. Let me tell you who was the greatest attorney general of modern times, and that was the former president of the University of Chicago, Ed Leavy. Ed Leavy was appointed by Gerald Ford, and his job was to come in after the Richard Nixon fiascos at the Justice Department and John Mitchell running it and the FBI still under the J. Edgar Hoover legacy and so forth. And his job was to restore integrity and public confidence in that agency. I don't know that you can restore public confidence in the DOJ today, but I think what Bill Barr intended to do, he had been the attorney general before he was a prominent Washington lawyer toward the end of his sort of 9-to-5 working career, and he had no need for the job. I think the reason he reentered it was not to aggrandize his own personal power or to build his resume. It was already on his resume, but right, to restore some sense of integrity. The Department of Justice has a difficult job because it's supposed to, on the one hand, implement the policy priorities of the President of the United States, and on the other hand, it's supposed to be a neutral enforcer of law. But I don't think anybody thought that the way that Hillary Clinton's campaign and Donald Trump's campaign were handled under the Obama administration was even-handed.
Also, he, by coming out, I think, and saying clearly the Justice Department does not see anything illegal in the vote. In other words, he comes out and basically thwarts Trump's politics in Georgia by speaking on a national level about some of the more hysterical voter fraud claims.
But at I took what he said as being he didn't see any of the widespread systemic right kind of frauds, and he included the word yet, which is prudent.
And the key phrase, too, was to overturn the election result.
Yes.
Exactly. Now, I have favored all along, you know, look, if you've got the good cases and so forth, bring them to court. Let's get this decided.
I too, but I think that by saying that, mm-hmm, and being clear about that, I thought was necessary, because the second part of what he did, mm-hmm, the signing the order for a special counsel, making John Durham the special counsel to go into all this, is, I think, the most critical thing, even more critical, I think, than the election of the president. Either way, it's the American understanding that if they think the FBI and the CIA and the intelligence services can be used in a Chicago way takedown as they may have been used by Obama, then we don't have a country. All we have is a banana republic without the nice weather.
That is so true. And I had come to think after the Mueller probe that we should never have another special counsel. And the reason for that is that when you set up a special counsel like that and give them essentially unlimited prosecutorial authority or something close to it, an unlimited budget, you give them also a target. It becomes their great white whale, and they're going to come back with something. And you don't really want prosecutors to do that. But I think it's important to set the background for what Barr did. First of all, when the new president comes in, he or she can appoint all the new federal prosecutors anyway.
Right.
And think about in the old days when Richard J. Daley, the mayor, was a critical figure in electing any Democratic president. And if you gave DeMayor a choice of one person he could appoint in the whole U.S. government, he wouldn't choose the Secretary of State or the Secretary of the Treasury, the big people. He would choose who is going to be the federal prosecutor for the city of Chicago. I mean, that's the thing that could endanger him.
And as we've seen over the decades, we've had several governors go to prison.
Right.
But not one mayor has ever been indicted because the fifth floor of Chicago City Hall must be like a fairyland of Narnia or something where there's no corruption.
Well, the point is, in this case, that a new president could come in and appoint all new federal prosecutors and would normally do that. But what we've seen is that the long time and completely independent figure, John Durham, who is the federal prosecutor for Connecticut, was tasked by Bill Barr to look into a series of very fundamental problems related to James Comey's FBI and so forth, and it might have extended into the White House and Department of Justice and so forth. That's been a long-running investigation, and I've thought, starting about 3 or 4 months ago, that Barr would be thinking, well, how could this whole investigation be shut down if a new president comes in? And the answer is, you could simply kill it off in a lot of different ways. And if you were Barr, you would, and you were an experienced inside worker, you would think, how can I make sure that this long-term investigation does not kill off? And what he did was to say, I'm gonna take the person who's doing it now and give him special protections against being fired. That's really what happened. And then he did something quite brilliant also, which is he did that before the election, before we knew who would be the next president, and did not announce it, avoided what James Comey did, which was go out in front of the cameras and say, I'm going to do this. So we are only learning about it now, but he did it over a month ago.
Yes, and I thought for both reasons, I appreciate Bill Barr very much. Charles, I have to ask you before we go that this COVID business is driving me crazy, okay? Not the COVID... Not the loss of breakfast and lunch and dinner time with my good friend Charles Lipson. I think the last time we had steak and eggs together was like 10 years ago, it seems now. But
yeah. The grandchildren of those cows are now in the field.
Let the record be clear that I took Charles Lipson to the Palm restaurant for breakfast because that's how we roll in the Chicago way. But
still looking for sponsors though. Don't
Oh really? Yes, we are anybody. Because we're not craven enough to crawl before them and seek them out. But the story that's breaking now again as I write this is this COVID mayor Stephen Adler of Austin. I assume he's a Democrat. who tells everyone he tells his people, the Austin Statesman has a story. He tells the people of Austin, stay home, don't relax about the pandemic. You must be, you know, stay at home. And he's doing this from Cabo, right? And then you have all these other politicians doing the same thing. I'd assume that there are some who are Republicans.
Oh, but absolutely. The mayor of Naperville in Chicago did the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, that was he was at a wedding. It was a religious function. And
okay, well, that's true. But he did make the point to say that I do believe the science, but I still would have gone.
Well, I have to tell you, if we're going to get into the science, we're going to get into trouble because, you know, I believe in the science that says there are only two biologists. Every biologist I know says there are only two genders, okay? So, and if I say I believe in the science, those scientists might be burned alive as heretics in today's America. So the question to me is politics, not science. So how do you, Charles, do we have any other historical points of reference here?
I think all these guys
going to the French Laundry and having dinner and then telling you not to have Thanksgiving at your house, all that stuff that they're doing.
While you and I were talking, I got an incoming email with the headline, "The Austin Mayor Has a Nice Suntan."
Is that from Corey Franklin? Who's that?
Mutual friend. No, it's actually from friends in Texas. And I have two adult children who live in Austin. So they paid attention to this too. What is the issue here? There are two. One is that people are now about at the end of their rope about how long they can stay indoors.
Right.
Right. But I think that the issue that you raised is that what we've seen in response to the pandemic is a centralization of executive power. So we have a lot of rules that are being promulgated by a mayor or a governor because we're in an emergency. But the longer the emergency lasts, not only do people get tired of it, but they say we can't have 2 and 3 year long emergency rules that give all this power to one person. This is the tyranny and centralization and anti-democratic stuff that we've had before. The final point is that the whole country, a big part of the populist movement on both the right and the left has been that people in power have cut themselves special deals. Rich people and people in power have formed a kind of alliance and cut themselves special deals. And so if you're the governor of California and you tell people they can't go out and eat indoors, and then you go to the fanciest restaurant in the state of California, the French Laundry, where nobody can get a reservation, and hold a group function there. And then I believe the mayor of San Francisco did the same thing. You have in LA a city councilor who's talking all about how we can no longer even have outdoor dining. And then just before she votes in favor of that, she goes to one of those places, contravening all the rules that she's about to put in place for everybody else. You have people saying, look, there's a two-tiered system here. And this isn't like the old airlines where you could buy a first-class ticket on the law. The laws are supposed to apply to everybody. And that was part of the issue with Hillary Clinton versus the Trump campaign, with Dianne Feinstein getting a briefing that she had a Chinese spy on her staff, but no such briefing going to Republican presidential candidates if the FBI was concerned and so forth. You get a sense that there's a two-tiered system of law, and people simply, Democrats, small d, won't put up with that, and we're right not to put up with it.
It's just infuriating to see this guy in Cabo telling people to stay home and stay indoors.
I'll offer the counterpoint too, and to Charles's point, mm-hmm. We are a democracy, and freedom is dirty and messy, and it causes plenty of problems because that's what freedom does. It allows people to have their own choices. You take gun control, you take mass shootings. I mean, people have this freedom. They do what they want. It happens. And it goes both ways. I mean, it's not just big D's. It's also big R's. I mean, if our president was in the same vein you know, coming out and saying, hey, you know, this is a serious problem. We need to do something. We need to mitigate this in certain steps. And if we do it the right way, we won't have to be super aggressive with it. And
so I completely agree.
That's what destroys me about it, because we are a democracy. We have all these great systems and checks in place to allow us to make the best decisions for the most good and not be forced to make those decisions, but to actually make those decisions as citizens. And the partisanship and the money involved in that partisanship has really deteriorated that little D to where it's you know, crumbling beneath the weight of everything else.
I couldn't agree more, Jeff. I think you put it just beautifully, and it's a terrible problem. It's not a problem associated with one party. And I would add one more thing to it. We live in a liberal, small L, democratic society, small L, small D, liberal democratic society. And to make that work, we have to tolerate differences among our population. You worship one way, I worship a different way. Somebody else doesn't worship at all. You and I are going to have different ways of pursuing life, liberty, and happiness. And as soon as we start saying, setting excessive boundaries on what each other can do to pursue that happiness, we begin to erode that basis for living together amicably in the society. And I think we've done that progressively over time. And we are allowing as much in civil society as in government to allow the mob to tell people, shut up. You can't do it that way. We don't like the way that you're pursuing happiness. And I think that that's a danger, too. So I think that we're in a very difficult position. I think it's a terrible thing to make vast, unsupported allegations that the people who will be coming into power in a little over a month don't have any legitimate right to enter power. We had that for 4 years, essentially, with Donald Trump, with the people who voted against him saying he was not a legitimate president. If Donald Trump, if Republicans have really strong evidence that there was massive fraud that would overturn this election, let's see it presented through the normal channels. Let's have it sorted out. If not, I think that it's a very bad thing to live through another 4 years of unending prosecutions, of thinking that people were not elected. And I think that what were not elected legitimately. And I think that what Bill Barr has done is a great service in saying, I haven't seen it so far. And if the president of the United States wants to fire me for saying that, so be it. But that's what I've seen. And I'm going to put it out.
I think that is a great summation of all, Charles Lipson.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you very much, Jeff. It's always fun to talk with you, really is.
It's like being in a class, isn't it, Jeff?
Oh, yeah.
It's like being in your favorite class where your professor can tell you about Montesquieu and Madison and Bill Barr and the ridiculous mayor of Austin.
Oh, Jeff, I meant to tell you, your paper is a little late. And you'll be marked down if you can't get in by the end of the week, okay?
And for those who are remote learning and aren't familiar with being in a classroom, this is like Wikipedia coming to life with a more legitimate sourcing.
With a beautiful voice, though, not one of the guy with the beautiful – the man who speaks Southern and speaks Chicago. I can't – this is just
a unique breed.
Ordinary. Thank you for being here, Charles Lipson.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Jeff. It's always fun.
Thank you.
And there you have it. For Charles Lipson,
Oh, hey, John, real quick, before we go, I've got some breaking news I want to drop on you while we're doing this. And I'm sure by the time this hits the ether, it'll be widespread, absolutely covering every paper and everyone jumping on this. But I need you to hear something if I can get this to work.
As someone who has spent time digging out my car before I had access to a garage, I absolutely understand it. But the problem with dips is, and I think Commissioner Tully would attest, when there's a new snowfall and we need to clear the street, the dips get in the way. So the dips get washed away. So I don't encourage dips. I understand that it's a longstanding Chicago tradition. And again, having been out there and, you know, shoveled the snow, dug my car out, got it running, I understand why people do it, but we don't encourage it.
That was Mayor Lightfoot, as we tape this, holding a press conference about an unrelated subject, but asked about dibs in the modern era.
I'm stunned, and I'm also upset. Not at Lightfoot, because she's just saying what the ruling class always says. You know, they live in high rises. They have their own doormen. Well, she doesn't have a doorman. She just has police officers who get red light tickets and I guess don't have to pay them. But if you live in the city and you live in a neighborhood where there's no parking, this is what happens. This is why I write about dibs. They've overdeveloped these neighborhoods. They don't have parking. There's not enough parking. I live in one. There's no parking anywhere. And I don't know what else do you expect people to do. This is a common, this is a rule of the commons, as the it's distinguished libertarian law professor Epstein has written. He's writing about dibs. He supports dibs, and I support the dibstitution.
Absolutely.
Right? Leave it alone, Lori. At your own peril, leave it alone.
On that note,
for Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus of the University of Chicago, writer of many books and articles, our friend, and you should look him up. Google him, look up his latest work at Real Clear Politics on Georgia and the Constitution. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio and producer of Chicago's Afternoon News with Steve Bertrand. And all those funny stories, except I don't think he's gotten to the one about the robotic hand yet.
Not yet.
Later he will. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist, editorial board member, Chicago Tribune, mutza giver, because you know why? When you tell me let's all move forward together, Alyssa Milano, you tell me that? You want to move forward together? Yeah, okay, but first, can I give you this mutza? Nah. Thanks for being here on the Chicago Way. See you next time.